Today we're going to do Genesis 22-23, the death of Isaac and the death of Sarah. We're going to look at both of those. I brought in a little flyer for you. It's a kind of an important detail within Genesis 22, because I thought the easiest way just let you just put that out there and let you read it. This is a way to interpret the seed word in Genesis 22. But I'll get to that. The question for today, remember when I left you last week, I said, you're going to read this. That was my command. That was my law to you. And the question I wanted you to think about and we can talk about is, how does Isaac die? How is it that he dies? And the second part of this question kind of goes back to the way many, many people look at this chapter. Is God being unusually cruel in asking Abraham to do this? So how does Isaac die?
In the form of a lamb.
In the form of a lamb. By proxy. Is God being unusually cruel in telling Abraham to do this? He's testing him, isn't he? Yeah. But you get into a test where God is taking something from you that you dearly love, and what do you say? Well, it's a very simple little word. Three letters. Why? Yeah. Think of this. Maybe you haven't considered this. This is reality. Have you died? Do you believe you've died? Did Isaac die? See, when Paul means when Paul says I've been crucified with Christ, does he mean really, or just it's a nice religious thought? And if he's considered dead by God, how can that be? So when next time someone asks you the question, how does Isaac die? Say the same way I died. Because Christ was sacrificed in my place. So how does God see me? Yeah, it's a way to start a conversation. What are some of the things that Isaac did, as you read this, that Isaac did that remind you of Jesus?
He submitted,
didn't he? Did he argue?
No.
How does that remind you of Jesus?
Without arguing.
Didn't defend himself. Carried the cross. What did Isaac do?
Carried the wood.
Yeah, Brenda got it. She sees that. And what was Isaac willing to do? Let his father do his father's will. You got to think, if he's strong enough to carry this wood all this way for this sacrifice, you think he's strong enough to whoop his father? He's willing to die, isn't he? Jesus, willing to die. What are some of the things that Abraham does that remind you of God the Father? So, God the Father in relation to Jesus.
He was willing to have his son die.
He's willing to have his son die. Okay, so that's what you mean by the lamb? Jesus is the lamb? Yeah, okay. His only son.
And God resurrected Jesus.
Yes, he did do that, didn't he? Huh? Didn't he do that? You get some insight from the book of Hebrews into this. See, here we get some insight from the book of Hebrews, but the writer of Hebrews, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, tells us this about Abraham. Yeah, so this really tells you two things that are really important. That Abraham, in fact, intended to kill him. The other thing is that he believed that he could get him back from the dead. Now he adds on a little, the writer of Hebrews adds on a little word, as a type. He received him back as a model, and then as a model of whom? What God would do in Jesus. Jesus would in fact die. He would in fact come back from the dead. Okay, so that's the big question for this passage. I think that's the focus of this. Is this is a model of what God would do in Jesus at this same place 1,800 years later. God being unusually cruel in telling Abraham to do this. Is he unusually cruel and having Jesus do what he did? A turning point in all of human history, Calvary. Here we go. Abraham sees. This is the word that describes this chapter. The word see. And I gave you the challenge last week. When you read through this, try to find all the places where it says see. It's hard to find the roots of this word in this chapter. I'm going to show them to you, but you can see the word see comes up because the very word Moriah, the place, is from the root of the word to see, and the word mirror comes from marar, And what's a mirror? You see your reflection. So the word could say, the Lord appears. And what did the Lord do at this place? Appeared, didn't he? He appeared to Abraham and said, don't do it. There's a lamb in the thicket. So here's Abraham, and he's told to go to this place. Now, twice before, Abraham had put his heir in jeopardy by lying. And now he's finally got this promise, and he's got this son, and God says, okay, go sacrifice him. So he's failed. He's failed and failed and failed. Now comes this test, and you look at the previous tests he's been through. What would you expect him to do?
Fail.
You'd expect him to fail because he's failed easier tests. This is a huge test. Why wouldn't he fail this? It shows you how far he's come in his faith toward God from the time that he, you know, first went into Hagar until now, from the second time he lied in Gerar until now. You can see that now he's got this son. His faith in God is fixed and focused, and God says, "Now I'm going to take away the thing most precious to you," and he's willing to give it up. This is the greatest test he's ever going to face, and you would expect he would fail, but he doesn't. And what God does here in Abraham is not only is he testing Abraham, but he wants us, the readers, to see what righteousness looks like in life. Because this isn't the place where Abraham becomes righteous, is it? Where's the place he becomes righteous? On that dark, starry night. And in fact, I think it was before that, but that's the night God declares him righteous to us. And here we see what righteousness looks like, and it's the kind of righteousness that he gives us. It's the kind of righteousness that he will test, and we will fail. He will test, and we will fail, but maybe not as severely. He will test, and we will have a victory. We will succeed. But it is a constant test of this righteousness. Because he wants other people to see what righteousness in the face of impossible situations looks like. And it's not a human work. It is God doing through us what we couldn't do for ourselves on our own power. It's not God taking us and doing something with us that we don't want to do. It's God working through us, through the things we want to do but don't have the capacity or the ability to do them. He will do them. It really is, like Romans says, it really is a co-op. It really is the power of God working within us as we will to do His will. Now, this place, Moriah, is pointing as a type or a model to what the Lord Himself will do in this same place 1,800 years later. So God is telling Abraham to do what I'm going to do later. And you think this isn't going to bother me? Because Abraham, if this bothers you, it's going to bother me. This is the place where the Lord appears, where the Lord is seen. Now, the lamb is what the Lord provided. Now, this gets trickier. Because the word provide is based on the word see. And what literally in Hebrew it says, the Lord will see to it. See to it. So every time you see the word provide in this chapter, it means see to it. Remember, Hagar named him El Roy, a God who sees. Here he's named Jehovah Jireh, the God who provides. Yireh, or see, is in the word Yireh. It's in those vowels. It's hard to hear in English, but you see it in Hebrew. The Lord sees to it the place, the substitute, and the greatest thing, the son returned to life. The son actually returned to life as far as from Abraham's point of view. His son was given back to him from the dead because we've already established what was Abraham's intent. Kill him, right? So if he didn't have to, he could kill a lamb in his place as a substitute. Then this lamb is dying instead of my son, so I get my son back. But in the mind of God, Isaac really died through the substitute. Now, the other thing that's fascinating about this chapter is the first time the word substitutionary, the idea of substitutionary atonement is really laid out. First time you have this idea of substitutionary atonement. And it's in the model of what Jesus would do later on. So you see, you never want to get to the point where you deny this whole doctrine or theology of substitutionary atonement, because that's the basis of our life, the basis of our salvation. Now, all the places the word see is used, I've listed them here. 4, 8, 13, and 14, two times. In 14, it's two times. And it's where Abraham really names the place. Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide." In Hebrew, "The Lord will see to it." As it is to this day, in the Mount of the Lord, it will be provided. It will be seen. The Lord will see to it. And it's almost a play on the word Moriah, especially in that last verse. Here's what Mount Moriah would have looked like. It would have looked something like this when Abraham went up there on that day with Isaac. It would have looked something like that. It was up on a high hill, so it was a perfect threshing floor. Now, why is that? Because what's a threshing floor? Throw the wheat up, wind blows the chaff, wheat falls back down. And it was owned by a man named Araunah, and David bought it from him. And David bought the land there, and God told Solomon later on, says in Chronicles, began to build the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, where? On Mount Moriah, where the Lord what? Had appeared. That's the word Moriah to his father David. It was on the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite, the place provided by David. So David bought it, and Solomon's going to build a temple there. And Solomon built a temple that looks something like this. Magnificent temple. What happened to it? When was Solomon's temple destroyed? 586. That temple got destroyed in 586. The Jews came back and was built under two men we studied about. We got to know very, very well. Who were they?
Zerubbabel.
Who was his priest? Joshua. So they went back and rebuilt the temple on the temple site under the ministry of Ezra, you said that, and Nehemiah. And they built this temple that was puny compared to this one. And the people wept who knew about this temple, because it was so puny. But the people who'd never seen this temple, they wept for joy because, hey, we got our temple back. And then Herod came along, who was an Edomite, who was an unbeliever, but a great man. Now, in terms of the world, he's a Steve Jobs, a Bill Gates, and he's a builder. And he built Jerusalem, basically. And when you go to Jerusalem, they all talk about Herod did this, and Herod did that, and Herod built this, and Herod built that. And he built this temple right here. Magnificent. A giant complex. It's at this place where Jesus came, and it's at this place where he died, on Mount Moriah, under the will of his Father. Totally submissive. And what happened to this temple? There you go. So who destroyed it? Titus, 70 A.D. All right, so anyway, the next part of this narrative, this story, this true actual account is that Sarah dies in Hebron. So at some point, they move back there. How many read chapter 23? Chapter 23 is a funny story. It's not funny because Sarah dies. It's funny because of the interaction between the Hittites and Abraham. And Abraham is grieving over his wife's death. I mean, he knows that she's in God's hands, but he's grieving because he's lost her. So he wants a place to bury her. But he's in a land where he doesn't own anything. He's still a sojourner. He's still a stranger. And everybody looks at him as a stranger. So he gets into this discussion with these Hittites who are living around Hebron. And he's saying, I need a place to bury my wife. I want to buy a place to bury my wife. Well, look at the first response they get. There's a whole group of them. In 23, 5, and 6, they're called the sons of Heth. These are the Hittites. Here is my lord, there meaning sir. That's a term of deference and respect. You're a mighty prince among us. See, he's rich. He's been rich since the first time he came back from Egypt. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead. Now, are they offering anything here? They're really not offering anything specific. They just say, oh, don't worry, you know, anybody will give you any grave you want. This kind of this magnanimous gesture. And Abraham comes back and says, well, really, I'd like to buy a place. Specifically, I've got a place specifically in mind. I'd like to buy it. He goes to Ephron in 10:9. He says, give me the cave at Machpelah, which Ephron owns, which is the end of the field. I will give him the full price. Give it to me as your burial site. So he says, I want that cave at the end of his field. That's all I want, just the cave. Ephron comes back and he says, no, my lord, hear me. I give you the field and I give you the cave. I'm going to give you the whole field and the whole cave. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Go ahead and bury your dead. Now, you have to understand, there's something going on here in the background that according to Hittite law, that if a landowner sells only a piece of a property, he has to pay the tax on the whole property. If he gives the whole thing away, he doesn't have to pay any taxes. But if he only gives him a piece of it, he has to pay tax on the whole thing. And he doesn't want to pay the taxes. If Abraham owns it, he has to pay the tax on the entire property. The other thing was, is that when Abraham dies, who owns the property? It can revert right back to the Hittites. This is your field while you're alive. You bury your wife there, but then she's buried there, but then he loses the rights to the grave after he dies. So what are his children going to do? So Abraham is saying, no, I don't want that. I want then the whole field. And he said, I'm willing to pay for you. Now here's what Ephron says. My Lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver. What's that between me and you? So bury your dead. What's 400 shekels between the two of us? You're a mighty man. I'm a leader in the gate. 400 shekels, nothing. That's an exorbitant amount of money. That's a ridiculous amount of money for this field. No fool is going to pay 400 shekels for that field and that cave, that tomb. This plot of ground, this field and this cave is not as big as Arunah's threshing floor. You know what David paid for the threshing floor of Arunah? Anybody know? 50 shekels. 400 shekels of silver is 100 pounds. And so Abraham gives him the money, buys the field. And this is a great step of faith on Abraham's part. Why is it such a step of faith on his part? Two things are happening to him. He has completely turned his back on his homeland. And he's now, this is an affirmation that this is my home, this is my land. And now he owns a piece of land in the land that God has promised him. And now he's looking ahead to say, I want a place not just to bury Sarah, I want a place to bury my family, my son Isaac, and his sons. And he said, I want a place that we will own, that no matter what happens, we can come back here and this will be ours. Because what's he know going to happen? God has told him back in Genesis 15, what's going to happen? They're going to be 400 years in Egypt and coming back. This is a statement by Abraham saying, I know even if God takes us out of this land, he's bringing us back and we're going to own this spot. And that's in Hebron today. And here it is. This is the tomb of Machpelah. And Machpelah means double tombs. And so what you have here in this site, you have Abraham and Sarah buried in one spot. You have Isaac and Rebekah buried in another spot. And you have Jacob and Leah buried in another spot. So you have these three couples, these six people, patriarchs and the matriarchs of the nation of Israel, all buried here in Hebron. And what happened to Rachel? She's buried in Bethlehem. We're about out of time. We'll come to some conclusions here. Abraham gave up Ishmael, and God blessed Ishmael. This isn't the first son that Abraham has to give up. What a blow. Take the son who you love. And then God says, Isaac. To me, he's my only one I have. And God says, you give him up. And God allowed him to live. Finally, Abraham believed his children would own this land. And that's why he bought the place to bury them all. Okay, for next week, Genesis 24 and 25. This is a long section because Genesis 24 is the longest chapter in Genesis. And Isaac marries and Abraham dies. You haven't been here for a while, so I'm going to have you pray because I like it when you pray and you haven't been.